question for you. Tell me who you think Jesus is. And you don't have to answer out loud, and you don't all have to answer at once, but I just want to ask you, who do you say that Jesus is? Well, I want to give you a couple possible answers and a couple New Testament responses to that question. Who do we say that Jesus is? Well, I want to take you first to Hebrews, and then I'll take you to Matthew 16 if you want to know where I'm reading. The author of Hebrews gave one answer. Hebrews 1, chapter 1, verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets, in many portions and in many ways in these last days, has spoken to us. How? In his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. There it is, the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sin, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become much better than the angels, as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. There's one response as to who Jesus is. I want to take you to another conversation. I want to take you over to Matthew 16. Rumors were swirling about Jesus, so Jesus initiated a conversation at verse 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he began asking his disciples, saying, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is? Who do others say? Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" Because Jesus knows there are reports. And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" There it is. He puts it point blank to them, his own disciples. "Who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, Simon, son of John, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." So I'll just pause there. So what do we get from Peter? Who is Jesus? Go ahead. The Son of the living God, the Son of God. That's the answer that we get in the Gospel of Matthew. So I suppose we could start the conversation this way. Mission control, we have a problem. Roger that. What's the problem? The problem is the deity of Jesus. Now you're going to look at me somewhat askance for a moment. Really, Jeff? The deity of Jesus? That's right. The deity of Jesus, because people don't believe it and they don't buy it. They don't buy into it. You know, there's a New Testament professor who's written a wonderful book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Gospels. And his prose is absolutely elegant. It just sparkles, but he's so engaging as a writer. And he was in the Middle East having a dialogue, a conversation with some Muslims. And they agreed that Jesus, and anybody know what Jesus is called by Muslims? Isa? Isa is the name of Jesus. They agreed that Isa was like Muhammad, a prophet. And then those who were in conversation with him added, and the Son of God. And that's when they turned to him and said, "No, not the Son of God. Son of Mary, yes. Son of Joseph, no. Son of God, no. There is only one name, only one God, and his name is Allah, and his prophet is Muhammad." They were implying that Jesus was perhaps illegitimate, that he didn't have a birth father that anybody could identify. And so for them, for Muslims, we know that Jesus is certainly not the Son of God. Somebody's son, sure, but not the Son of God. You see, for Christians, the deity of Jesus is at the heart and the core of our faith. It always has been. It has from the very beginning. It was controversial then, Jesus, in his own day. It was controversial. It was controversial later when the author of Hebrews was thinking back and writing about Jesus. Who is he? It's a problem that has been with us for 2,000 years. Who is Jesus? And in Matthew 16, Jesus understood that. And he understood that there were rumors circulating about who he might be. And so he was the one who initiated the conversation and posed the question, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they gave him an answer, the Son of Man, well, it could be John the Baptist, it could be Elijah, it could be one of the other prophets. And then if you think the Son of Man has anything to do with Jesus, if you think there's a connection here, and it's certainly implied, but being very careful as we handle the scripture, Jesus then puts the question to them, so who do you say I am? Even the way that he asked the question is a clue to what he might be looking for. I am. Who is the great I am? It's a very interesting way that Jesus poses the question. Who do you say that I am? Now, how would you answer if you were put on the spot? If somebody asked you, who do you say I am? Is Jesus still talking about the Son of Man? Or is he talking about something else? Is he inferring that he is the Son of Man? The way he asked it, who do you say that I am? Certainly they must have noticed that there was a strange connection here. This was, after all, a man who could heal others, who could deliver people from demons or demonic power. Those who were demonized, Jesus could deliver them, and he preached good news. There was something about this man. When he spoke with authority, and he expected things to happen. Even the demons obeyed him, they knew, and people were healed. So somebody of power was here. Well, Peter responded to that question. And don't you love Peter, impetuous Peter? He blurts out the answer. And guess what? He gets it right, too. He offers the right answer. What does he say? He says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And he has the right answer. And Jesus goes on instantly to affirm that. And he says, well, it's the right answer, but flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. Now, isn't that interesting? What he's suggesting is that Peter didn't figure this out on his own. He didn't come into it by himself. There isn't a single one of us that is going to recognize or know Jesus as the Son of God unless it's given to us, revealed from above. Somehow a window has to be opened before you and I get it, before the light bulb goes on. Oh, yeah, you're the Son of God. You are the Messiah. You are the Christ. But I love the way that Jesus says it. My Father in heaven revealed this to you. My Father? Wait a minute. What are you saying, Jesus? This puts him, I think, on a different level from most of us. My Father? You mean he's not our Father? I think Jesus is suggesting something powerful here. He does indicate to his disciples that this had to be made known to them from outside. It was not something that most ordinary human beings could figure out by the powers of observation. It's not obvious at all. And 2,000 years later, it still isn't obvious to people. So it was all good for Peter. He got the right answer. But the problem with Peter was that he didn't know how he got the right answer. He had it, but he didn't know where it came from. And I always think when I read this particular story or hear these words, I always think of the student who has the right answer in geometry. And then the teacher says, okay, take the piece of the chalk and go up on the board and show me how you got the answer. Go ahead, work the proof so that we can follow you. How'd you get there? And Peter's, he doesn't know. Because Jesus goes on to tell them, let me tell you what it means to be Messiah, what it means to be the Son of the living God. This is what it means. The Messiah will suffer and be killed and then rise. And Peter looks at him and he goes, oh, no, not you, Lord. Bad theology. Not you. Heaven forbid that this should happen to you. You see, Peter had the right answer, but he had no clue as to what it really meant. He doesn't understand where it came from. Some of you have had a chance to read a book, and some of us are reading it as a group, and it's by Brooks E. Cavey. What a name, Brooks E. Cavey. And he's the teaching pastor at the Meeting House, a large church in Toronto, Canada. And he was having a conversation with a woman who was a spiritual seeker one day. And oddly enough, she said, you know, I'm drawn to Jesus, and I just can't help myself. There's something about him. And I find myself wanting to follow him, but I can't understand how any person could somehow be God. I don't get it. How can a person be God? So Brooks E. Cavey just thought for a moment and he said, well, how about if we turn the question around? Could God become a human being? And she thought for a moment and then she looked at him. She said, oh, yeah, God can do anything. And then as she heard her own words, she started to smile and said, oh yeah, I get it. God can do anything. And then they realized that she had been starting at the wrong end of the question. You don't start here. You start at the top of the ladder. You start from above. What's given to us, what's made known, when the window is open and we go, oh yeah, now I get it. Not from our experience, but from something that's shown and made known to us. You know, the scandal is what the biblical word for this, and the scandal for early Christians in the early church was not that a man could become God, not that a human being could work his way up and even perhaps become a god or be elevated to that. The scandal for them was that the creator of the cosmos would shrink himself and would dare to become human like us. That did not make sense to them. It was absolutely incomprehensible. The issue was not that deity was attributed to humans, but that humanity would be attributed to the deity. Did you get that? That God would want to become one of us. We call it the incarnation from the Latin word incarnatus. And you hear nativity in there, meaning in the flesh or enfleshments. That's all it means. I mean, why in the good for goodness sake would anybody want to do that? Why would God want to become one with us? The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, in the late 19th, early 20th century, found this absolutely appalling. He thought Christianity was only for the weak. It didn't make sense for him. The Greeks, well, those in the environment in which Jesus lived in the first century, the Greeks rejected this notion and said, life is all about perfection and transcending the world of human limitations. Have you ever looked at Greek art and how they, let's use the word venerate. They venerated the perfect human form. Have you ever looked at some of the Greek vases and things? How the form is always very symmetrical, and the human beings are incredibly proportioned, strong and powerful and athletic. So the goal for the Greeks was to realize the ideal. What we experience on earth is less than the ideal. It's good, but what's going on up there, out there, that's the ideal that we shoot for. So for them to hear about a God who became one with us going in the opposite direction, it simply didn't make sense. Let me ask you a question. Who does Hollywood make television shows and movies about? Don't they make them about the rich and the famous, the beautiful, the athletes, the artists, the musicians, the successful, the Kardashians, Kobe, Ice Cube, people who are successful in some way at what they do? They don't make movies or television shows very often about bums on Skid Row or addicts in meeting in church basements and AA groups or homeless drifters or down and outers. They just don't make shows about people like that. And would we watch them if they did? Would they be popular? I don't think they'd last long. How many people really want to do what Mother Teresa did? Do you really want to go to a slum in Calcutta and take care of the poorest of the poor, the neediest of the needy, the sickest? Do you want to wash their feet oozing? Do you want to do that? Not many people do. Carnival Cruise Lines, they'll offer you a voyage, but where do you think they're going to take you? To some exotic location down in the Yucatan, or someplace like Monaco, or, well, someplace in the French Riviera, someplace wonderful. They don't typically offer you a voyage to a swamped village in Bangladesh. They're not going to take you to a refugee camp full of Syrians running and fleeing for their lives. They're not going to take you to the cancer ward full of kids. They just aren't. They're not going to take you to those places. You see, the people in our world, they want that ladder. They want to rise high. They want to climb. They want to be elevated. They want to succeed. They want more money. They want to be promoted. That's the way the world teaches. Those are the world's value. Those are the values of the world system. So when we hear God talking about downward mobility, we don't get it. And we don't either. They weren't the only ones who don't get it. Who'd want to do that? Nobody really wants to do that. How many of you make it your aim, your ambition to fail? Or seemingly in the eyes of the world. Do you want to end up on a cross? If you don't think that was a failure and the abnegation of everything that Jesus represented, who wants to wind up there? Anybody want to wind up going to the electric chair? Oh, they don't use that anymore. It's by injection now. Who wants to wind up there? Any volunteers? No? How many of you would like to succeed this week, get promoted, rewarded with a raise. Oh, now we're talking, Jeff. Yeah, me too. We don't get it. We still don't get it. You see, I said the deity of Jesus was controversial. It's still a problem for us every bit as much as it was for them. What do we understand? Well, we get Adam and Eve. What did Adam and Eve want? They wanted to be like God. He's holding out on us. That was what the serpent taught them. You sure he's not holding something back off from you? He says, don't eat from that tree. Oh, really? Why should you not eat that fruit? You sure it's not good for you? God knows. He's holding out on you. He has something good. Well, we didn't understand until it was too late that God was trying to protect us. But we get it. They just wanted the best for themselves. They wanted more. And we have a God, however, who moves in the opposite direction. How many of us would willingly surrender, voluntarily give up power? How many people will have to die before President Assad relinquishes power in Syria? How many? Hundreds of thousands have already been killed. Why? What is he trying to hold on to? You see, that's the way of the world, and people die for it every day. You know, one of the most controversial topics still today is the deity of Jesus. We just don't understand it. What self-respecting God would leave behind the incredible plushness of some extraordinary palace to come down here to earth? Can you imagine the creator of the cosmos, the sovereign God, coming to earth? You want to talk about getting small or getting down? This is it. It's moving in the opposite direction for sure, and I'm not sure I understand it. You know, you read Greek mythology. We all have. We've heard the stories in school growing up about gods coming down from, where was it, Mount Olympus? And when they wanted to go slumming or have a little mischief or mix things up with human beings, a little bit of trinken und spielen, they wanted to play around. It's no wonder that the Greeks always said it would be better if the gods would just stay away from us, let us alone, stay up there. Because any time the gods got involved with human beings, it usually meant misery and mischief for us. They called it fate, and they didn't want any part of it. But for Jesus to come, for Jesus to come as a representative of God in the human flesh and to love others and to serve and to help us, it simply was incomprehensible, and it didn't make sense to them. And as far as I know, none of you had a choice as to whether to be born. Anybody here know if you had a choice? I don't think I had a choice. I didn't decide whether I would be born or where I would be born or when I would be born. I didn't get to pick my sex, did you? I didn't get to pick my skin color. I didn't get to pick my parents. I didn't get to pick my body size either. There are a lot of choices that simply aren't given to us. This was God's idea, and he meant it for good, even if we don't always do good things with the opportunities that he presents. You see, I think it's up to most of us, and Voltaire put it this way, it's up to us to make the best of a bad situation. The hand, the card hand that you're dealt with, that was Voltaire who said it several hundred years ago. You have to make the best of the hand that you have been dealt. But Jesus, it wasn't that way. We say that Jesus had a choice. He didn't have to come, but he did. He elected to come for us. He had a choice. He served the Father. He obeyed God. Voluntarily, he surrendered some of his divine attributes. Paul says it this way in Philippians 2. He humbled himself by becoming a bondservant. He emptied himself, is what it really says. That's how far he went, of his divine attributes, so he could be one with us and experience life as we know it. He came in the flesh, God in the person. Where did he come? To earth, to us, you and I. Now, I suppose we all would like to be like gods from time to time, but isn't it interesting that God moves in the opposite direction? We want to rise, and he wants to come down to be with us. Isn't that interesting? We want to be like God, and what does he want? He wants to become human. I kind of like that when I begin to catch on to what I think he might be doing. God wants to become human, but what a reversal this is, and it doesn't always make a lot of sense. But go with me for just a moment. Why? Why would God want to do this? Why? God? Why would he want to do this? Well, I suppose one of the answers we could offer is this: because it was his way. It was his way of doing it. He didn't have an alternative, if that's possible. It was costly, but what if this was the only alternative, even for God? And I can't understand that. If you're God, how can that be the only option and the only alternative? At this point, it becomes a mystery. And if I could understand it, well, then maybe God and I would have to switch places. But I have to be humble about this, and so do we all. We don't get it. You can't explain it. Finally, if we could explain it, I think maybe we would understand God. And I don't think we're ever going to understand that. But it was God's way, his chosen way, perhaps the only way, but it was his way. And why did he do it? Well, he did it because we needed help. He recognized that we were weak and vulnerable and needy. We needed to be rescued. Christianity is a rescue religion. We were trapped. The way that Paul says it in the New Testament, we are enslaved, you and I, to sin. We're imprisoned by our own choices, our bad choices that don't always work out. And why does God do this? Why does he come to help? One word. Love. What do you say to that? Love. Love is its own reason. It's inexplicable. Why do you want to spend time with the people that you love? Do you have to explain it? I don't think we can. You just do. That's why God came. I think it was because he couldn't stay away. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, I was foolish and, let's be honest, I was reckless and undisciplined in some ways, and I was irresponsible, and I was weak. And I have quite a resume. I wrecked my father's car. I got kicked out of college. I got busted, all within a fairly short period of time. Impressive resume. I don't always trot that out there, not if I want to have a job. But that was part of my story, and that's what happened to me. And I can remember having to explain, well, I couldn't explain it, it's just what happened. How do you explain that to your parents? And you see your father, they're like, now tell me again, why did you do this? What were you thinking? And the typical teenage boy, I don't know. I still don't know. Why did I don't know exactly. I'm not sure I can give you an answer. If I could give you an answer, maybe I would have made a different choice. But that's what happened. And I was afraid of my parents, especially my father. If you knew him, he was a pretty scary guy. And I just thought, oh my goodness, they're gonna kill me. Anybody ever done something where they thought you were afraid to come home or to make that call? Mom? Dad? This is what happened? Or you were reluctant to go home? Ever been that way, Riley? No, probably not you, huh? But many of us can identify with that. There were things that we had done and we were ashamed of. Oh, they're going to kill me. And the truth is, as I've switched places and become a parent and come to understand them better, they didn't want to kill me. They didn't. Oh, well, they might have for a little while. They might have felt like it, but I'm still here, so they didn't do it. And neither did yours, and neither will we. What we really want is the best for our children. We want them to have life. We want them to succeed and do well and do better than we did. And we are willing to sacrifice for them. And it's costly. They had to sacrifice for me. Yep. I could tell you it took me a long time to begin to pay back my father for that car. But he paid for it up front. I mean, it was costly for him. This was the car that he had for work and the only one. And he had to figure that out. So it cost him something. What I did discover is that my parents, well, they never stopped loving me, not through all of that. They gave me not what I deserved and not what I earned, but they gave me what I needed to succeed, what I needed for life. Now, I'm going to tell you that they didn't try to spare me all the consequences. They didn't do that. They had the wisdom and sense. No, you did this, and now you're going to reap what you've sown. Some of the things we can't help you with, and if you need to learn the hard way, then that's how it is. But I was still their son through all of this. I was still their son, and I knew that I was loved. But the relationship was jeopardized. They weren't exactly thrilled, and there wasn't much trust there. And I was uncomfortable around them, and perhaps they were uncomfortable around me until I finally came to that point where I could say, I don't know what I've done. And I know it affects you, and I just don't know how deeply, and I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I don't know what happened, but please forgive me. I realize that I did something wrong that hurt you deeply. And then you know what happens when you can finally say those words? Well, you were always the son, but the relationship becomes a right relationship again. The broken relationship is restored, and it becomes right again. And on that basis, you can start to rebuild trust. But the love was always there. The relationship was always there. I was still their son. They were still my parents. But now it's becoming a right relationship again. And if I catch on to what the New Testament says about Jesus, that's what God is doing with us. He wants to restore that right relationship. He's mad about us, not at us. Perhaps he ought to be mad at us, but he's not. There's more to it than that. You know, the truth is that some of us have the wrong idea about God. We don't understand that God is love, and that's the only way that God behaves toward us. We know what's in the hearts of people. We look around at the circumstances of history, and we can read about murder and genocide. We know that people lie because we've all done it. People are manipulative and self-seeking, and some of them are guilty and ashamed. And some of them, they're liars, and they're deceitful, and they practice violence. We know. It's in our hearts, too. I may not have murdered anybody, but I've thought it before, and so have you, if you're honest. Every one of us has, and it's for those things that we are indicted and stand convicted. The truth is that people are pretty yucky, aren't they, Romeo? Once in a while, people, well, they will screw you over, won't they, William? They do it all the time. They say things that are cruel and ugly and thoughtless and insensitive and downright mean and nasty, and they want to hurt you. And we've done the same thing. We get it. People are yucky. So here's the question. Why, if you were God, would you want to come into that? You got to be kidding me. The Greeks didn't understand it. The world doesn't understand it. Nietzsche, one of the greatest philosophers ever, even if you don't like his philosophy, that man could think. He didn't get it. And I'm not sure that we do either. The one who told us about that, what did we do? We nailed him to a cross. We killed him. Nobody liked it. So who do you say? I am. Who do you say that Jesus is? All I could tell you from reading the New Testament and from seeing the cross and the nativity, the incarnation, we have a God who loves us, who cares for us because people matter. Excuse me. You matter. Peggy, you matter. Madge, you matter. Riley, you matter. Doris, you count. Elaine, you matter. Your life is significant. If you were the only one, he would have done this for you. If you were the only one in the universe who needed this, he would have come for you. For one, he would have done it. Being human matters to him. Remember how Genesis started when God created and he looked at the human beings, Adam and Eve? He didn't just say it was good. He said they were, after they were created, suddenly all of creation was very good. We were his crowning achievement. And even though we be fallen, God is still impressed with his work and what he has done. He has an investment in us. And he cares so much that he hasn't abandoned us. If you have a dented can in the cupboard, if your spouse scratches the car, if you get a big gouge out of your table, are you going to get rid of the table? Are you going to dump the car? Are you going to throw the can away? Or are the contents still good? Will you still drive the car even if somebody keyed it? Will it still perform? Will it still function? You see, God hasn't given up on us. And even though some of us are scarred, it's supposed to heal, and that's what God is all about. And at the very place where there's been a break, don't bones knit together even tighter? So at the very place where there was a rupture, God wants to bring us back together and heal it so it's better than ever, better than before. You see, if being human is good enough for God, why can't it be good enough for us? Years ago, I sat in a worship setting, and I've told this story, but there was a German couple, university professors. They took their children, and I think I'm going to end him here and bring back the worship team. They were part of the university system in Germany. They made a great income, both of them professors, but they went to Africa to help orphans. They went to one of the African nations that was torn by civil strife, a civil war had broken out, people were dying, and they went there to take care of those who had been orphaned. And I was sitting right behind them. I had no idea that they were going to be platform speakers in front of thousands of people. We just chatted amicably back and forth as I got to know them a little bit, and I heard part of their story, but it wasn't until they got up on the platform, like, who are these people? Well, they were really the most incredibly humble people that I had known. But to hear their story, they went to Africa to help round up and take care of orphans, people whose parents had been killed in the fighting or perhaps by AIDS, and they gathered as many children as they could, several hundred before they were finished. And as I thought about that, when they were up on the platform later speaking, and I remember thinking to myself, how in the world could they do giving up all that they had, you know, the Western way of life in Germany? Great income, safe place for their children, good future, good lives, great prospects for advancement. All of that to go and to be on the run in Africa? Are you kidding? How can they do that? And I didn't, well, it was one of those questions I had. I just didn't expect God to give me an answer. And he spoke to me and he said, they can't. And that took me back. What do you mean they can't? And he spoke to me and he said, they can't, but I put my love in them because I called them to do this. I asked them to do it. I sent them to do it. So I gave them a love for these children. In the natural, no, Jeff, you couldn't do it. I could not have done that, but I wasn't called to do that. They were. What God called them to do, he also empowered them to do. That's a basic biblical principle. If God calls you to do something, John, he's going to make sure you also have his power to finish it, to follow through. He doesn't ask you to do something unless he also gives you the power to do it, to realize it, to make it come about. He gave them his love for those children. There was no place they would rather be than with those war-torn, hungry, starving, ragged children. No place. And it was his love that empowered them to do it. So you want to know what the incarnation is all about? What brought you here? What are you looking for? Judgment? I don't think so. Most of us are looking for mercy. Lord, have mercy on me. I'm a sinner. I'm broken. I'm weak. I'm vulnerable. And although I can dress up pretty good on a Sunday and comb my hair and look pretty nice and I have good words and I'm fairly articulate, you don't know the truth of it. You don't know my heart. But God has the ability and knows how to judge the thoughts and intentions of every one of our hearts, yours and mine. It says that he doesn't reject us. He came. He came to this world. He comes here today. He's sitting where you sit. And I wouldn't be surprised right now if he's speaking to some of you. Joanne, Alexis, Peggy, I know who you are. I know where you are. I know everything there is to know about you. And I love you. And there's a work that I want to do in you, through you, with you, and for you. Will you allow me to come and take my proper place? That's the incarnation. He wants to come alive and be born anew in us so that we can be born again in him. That's what Christmas, Charlie Brown, is all about. Let's pray.